You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
My guest today is Karen Brooks Hopkins, who worked at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, BAM, for 36 years. 16 of those years, she served as president of the legendary cultural institution. She has written this terrific book that's part memoir, part leadership tome, and part tour guide to Brooklyn and the arts world. The book is called BAM, And Then It Hit Me. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job, at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock.
Karen Brooks Hopkins, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, I am too. So I've been looking forward to this conversation for several reasons. And one of those reasons is based on a line you write in the prologue of your book. You write, quote, "As I declared on many occasions to my 36-year run to the board, staff, artists, audience, and anyone else who crossed my path, BAM was not a job, but a crusade," end quote. Talk more about that.
You know, it was a situation that required 100% dedication at all times. That was the way that I approached the job, and that was the way that I expected my colleagues and staff members to also approach the job. And I think because there was this attitude about work, this attitude of dedicated service, this attitude of respect for the audience, respect for the artists, respect for the building, that we were all together bonded in what I called a crusade. Now, that word has become more politically incorrect. So in the book, I went back to the dictionary and found a way to define it that I felt gave it enough credibility that we didn't have to take it out of the book because it wasn't politically correct. I think the definition was something about, you know, having almost religious or passionate fervor for mm-hmm. the thing that you were dedicated to. And that is how I felt about BAM. And of course, there's the famous story that I tell about fundraising, where every morning I would, you know, get up, do my exercises, take my shower, get dressed and ready for the day. And the last thing I would do before leaving the house would be to look in the mirror, clench my fist, and say, "Good morning, Karen. Today you will raise $1 million." And out I went. And this was my mantra. You know, yeah, that I had to kind of pump myself up every day for the job. And when you do that over 36 years, you know, it takes a lot out of you, but it also gives you a lot because you don't have to question your commitment. Your commitment is a fact. Your commitment is in your heart and in your soul. And when you feel that way about a job, it defines who you are.
Yeah. I mean, I'm in my 36th year at Second City.
Fantastic.
And, you know, and I started in the late 80s. And I think one of the things that I've learned about this industry, that theater people are very similar to like startups in the sense that, you know, when you have to make something out of nothing, which is something that we do in improvisation, which you had to do, because, I mean, Brooklyn Academy of Music was not BAM when you started.
Correct.
And startups, you know, basically they have to do everything. So you know, you're conceiving of the thing, you are selling the thing, you are making the thing. And that's exactly what we had to do in our jobs. And I want to talk a bit about your origin story, because you were 23 and you were working at a theater in D.C. when the Yom Kippur War broke out, and that took you to Israel, right?
Yeah.
Talk to us about that.
I was working at a Jewish community center in Washington, D.C., running their theater program. And after like the third year of, you know, Happy Hanukkah, Charlie Brown, I was really looking for an exit strategy. But I also was quite dedicated to, you know, the work that I was doing. I'd been there for a few years. And let's face it, when you're a young person who believes that your career was going to be in the arts, you're happy to have a job doing whatever you're doing. So I tried to make a really great program at the Jewish Community Center. And then the war broke out in Israel, and my friend and I decided to volunteer. So it was kind of this crazy moment where we and thousands of other young people had an interview, a medical checkup, and then they told us that they would call us and that we should be prepared. They told us what to pack and that we would have a certain period of time to get to Kennedy Airport, to get on a flight that would take us to Israel. Mm-hmm. And it was actually quite dramatic because, I mean, I was living in Washington, D.C. at the time, and they called. And I remember I was at my grandmother's house, and the first thing I did was slam my hand in a door. You know, like I was so nervous. And then, of course, we packed up. We went to New York, and there were like thousands of kids hanging out. But we were sequestered because of security in a certain portion of the airport. The kids had guitars. You know, remember, this was the early 70s. So it was the moment, you know, for our generation. Kids had guitars. Kids were hanging out. You know, it was a whole thing. And then they put us on a plane. And off we went. And when we arrived in the darkness because there was war and obviously the airfields were not lit. And we arrived and it was quite a moving moment. You know, you could kind of see the Stars of David on the airfield coming up as the sun came up. Mm-hmm. And you... you know, they played, you know, the Israeli national anthem over the sound speaker on the airplane. And then we arrived and were assigned to work on a kibbutz. And of course, I got a job working in the laundry because that's where all the gossip happened. And also because it was warm from all the machines. So that was kind of my origin story as far as Israel was concerned. Of course, I'm very sad today to see the current situation, not that war is good at any time, but one that doesn't seem to resolve. But it was a particular formation aspect of my life, doing the volunteer service for the year that I did and learning about, you know, working in a laundry, being part of a communal system and so forth. It set me up probably for a life in the theater.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. So you met your first husband there. You move back. How do you get in Harvey's office? How did that happen?
What happened was some friends of mine from University of Maryland had started a theater called New Playwrights Theater in Washington, D.C. And by this time, I was really tired of the JCC. And I said to them, what do you need someone to do? I'll do anything. I just want to be in an actual theater and not in a community center. And they said, we need someone who can raise money. I said, okay, I'll do it. And I went and I just kind of had the fundraising gene. I immediately kind of understood what to do. But what happened was I applied for a week. A service organization was offering weeks at the O'Neill Center in Waterford, Connecticut, to learn skills for young arts administrators. And I applied for a fundraising week and got accepted. And during that week, it all came together for me. I really understood the process. It locked in for me. And I knew at that moment that my spiritual home was going to be New York, that if I was going to work in the theater, that I wanted to be in New York. And I'd heard that BAM was building a development department, and someone who was with me at the O'Neill Center, introduced me, and I got an interview. And the interview with the development team there led me to an interview in Harvey Lichtenstein's office, who was the president of BAM, a legendary president, and he was the one who, in fact, hired me.
And I love that he said to you, "Look, Karen, I need someone who can work like hell," and you weren't afraid of that.
And he looked at me and he said, "Yes, I need someone who can work like hell." And I said, "I'm your gal." And we shook hands. He hired me, and that was it. I worked with him for 20 years until he retired, and then I succeeded him as president in 1998. So he was tough. He pushed us really hard. But that's also where this kind of crusade mentality kicked in during those Harvey years. Mm-hmm. He was on a path for glory, and we were all on it with him, and nothing was going to stop us.
Now, I imagine when you were thinking you needed to be in New York, you weren't thinking Brooklyn?
It's true. I wasn't thinking Brooklyn, but once I saw BAM, and it's amazing, beautiful historic theaters. You remember that the first BAM was opened in 1861 during the American Civil War, burned to the ground in 1903. That one was in Brooklyn Heights, and a committee of 400 citizens of Brooklyn raised the money to open the current building at 30 Lafayette Avenue, which has a beautiful 2,000-seat opera house, a big upstairs space now known as the Adam Space, various studios, and then, of course, we've added movie theaters and other theaters since that time. So when I saw this historic theater in this kind of rundown neighborhood, I realized that, unlike Manhattan, we could do whatever we wanted, and no one would care. And there was a lot of freedom in that as long as we could pay for it. And that kind of set off a light bulb that if I was a fundraiser in a situation such as this, it would be tough, but the potential was unlimited. And that being a fundraiser there would make me a really important part of the team. And so when I was offered the opportunity, I said yes, and that was it. It was then my life.
I think, you know, for contemporary audiences, people who've been to Brooklyn in the last 5, even 10 years, maybe, they don't know what it was like then. And I think about this in the context of the reason the Second City is called the Second City is because A.J. Liebling, writing for The New Yorker, just hated his time in Chicago and said it's not a first city, it's a second city. So we adopted the put down. And you talk in the book, you say, quote, "It didn't make sense, given our Brooklyn location and our budget, to try to be a second-rate Lincoln Center. We decided it was better to be a first-rate BAM." That's it. Yeah.
The second city analogy is perfectly, because we said, what are we doing? Let's just double down on Brooklyn. There's no point in trying to get around it or through it or whatever. We are it. And once we owned it, it was a badge of honor. And we decided to make it great. And we decided that the best way to do that was to create the most tightly branded cultural institution in the city, maybe in the country. And that is when we came up with our idea and mission of really focusing on adventurous work for adventurous artist audiences and adventurous ideas. You know, we had a phrase that said it more specifically than what I'm saying right now, but the idea was that everything would involve experimentation, be with a twist, have an avant-garde point of view. So when you saw opera at BAM, it was BAM opera. It was not like you'd see anywhere else. And this extended to the signage on the building. Every email, every communication had a certain look, a certain vibe. There was complete continuity. And I believe that the idea of an institution that speaks in one voice, where all of the administrative support, the fundraising, the marketing, and so forth, all feel like the program. that is when you can really communicate and knock out all the clutter. And that is what we did. We found our mission and we stuck to it. And another part of that was, if we wanted to do something and it didn't work the first time, we simply said, we're going to do it again, 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 and just keep on doing it until it worked. Or if it didn't work after all that time, then we might consider not doing it. But most of the time it did. I mean, like, we did foreign language theater and everyone thought it was a joke. Everybody said, no one's going to listen to theater in foreign language with subtitles, with simultaneous translation. But our point was that some of the greatest directors in the world, Giorgio Strehler, Ingmar Bergman, Ninagawa, you know, they weren't working in English. And we wanted them on our stage. So we did it in a foreign language. We booked it for less performances, obviously. And we kept rolling until we built an audience. And now it's quite common. You see it all over the place.
Yeah, but then it wasn't. And I was thinking about this. So many incredible artists sort of early in their career that you were working with. And I remember my dad worked at WGN Radio here for 33 years. And every Friday he'd come home with his stack of record albums. And I'm the youngest of six boys. And there was the rule was always in our house, the oldest to the youngest. So the oldest would, you know, grab the Eric Clapton record or the Bob Marley or whatever. And then I'm the youngest, I'm six, and I'm getting these artists they'd never heard of, Joe Jackson, Elvis Costello. And only like years later, them all trying to force trades on me, you know, with this stuff. And I think about that when I was looking at the Next Wave series, which became the Next Wave Festival. And you're talking Philip Glass, Steve Reich, the Flying Karamazov brothers, Laurie Anderson, Bill T. Jones. I mean, talk about being at, I mean, you were at the apex of a great art movement before the world would know it was a great art movement.
That's absolutely correct. I mean, Harvey knew, and he brought Joe Melillo, who was his artistic deputy. I was the business guy, and Joe was the art guy. And the three of us were kind of a leadership triumvirate with other people, our marketing people and so on, our finance people. But Harvey just, he had an instinct for things that were not usual. He had an instinct for originality across all art forms. And he just was one of those learnaholics, you know, he just kind of sucked it all in and we followed him. So when other institutions in New York were, you know, bringing New York, that had New York artists on their stages and American artists, we were in Europe. When they were in Europe, we were global. And we just kept moving out in order to find the next great thing. But it was Harvey who brought Robert Wilson's large-scale work to New York for the first time. It was Harvey who brought Laurie Anderson's major work. It was Harvey who introduced Pina Bausch. And then Joe followed on by things like The Bridge Project that Sam Mendes directed and so many other pieces. So we had a curatorial point of view, and we had curators that really worked hard to find the world's greatest artist that no one knew yet. And we gave them a home. That was the concept.
You have so many great stories, and I'm going to prompt you for one. But I was thinking about, I remember a bunch of Peter Sellers, the famed director, was working at the Goodman Theater doing his Merchant of Venice. And it was going to be a very experimental Merchant of Venice. And Del Close was cast in it. So Del, legendary improv guru, would die just a few years later. We go to this production. It was probably around 5-6 hours long. The sound was sort of purposely muddied. A lot of the actors had their backs to the audience. Most people left. And I'm there with Adam McKay, now a very famous film director and writer, but then was just a Second City guy. And we go up to talk to Del. We stayed, and it was a mess, but we kind of had fun with it. And we were talking to Del, and then Peter Sellers comes over, and we have a conversation. And a gentleman walks over to our group and goes, "Mr. Sellers," and then gives him the finger and says, "Now we're even," and then walked away. And I was like, okay, I got to share that moment. And you mentioned Pina Bausch, and I wonder if, like, Is the water story like maybe one of the biggest near fiascos you ever had?
The water story was pretty intense because she was doing a piece. I'm trying to remember the name of it. It's a German name. I'll think of it. And the stage had to be flooded with water. You know, all of her work is very, you know, there are trees growing. There are fields. There are tons of dead leaves. In this particular case, it was a pool on stage that was filled with water. And it's called Arion, German name. And the dancers cavort and dance in the water. And at some point, I think it's a rhinoceros comes out and also is cavorting in the water. And New York was having a drought and we couldn't get water. So we had to order the water from New Jersey.
As one
and
does.
They sent us contaminated water that had like cleaning fluid. We put a thermometer in it to check the temperature and the thermometer melted. Then we had to bring like a SWAT team of guys in hazmat suits to come over and get the water out of the parking lot where it was all being stored, getting ready to move it to the stage. So then we had to get a new shipment of water and we couldn't get it heated up in time for the show to start that night. And we had guys, I mean, our corporate supporters stepped right in. The Brooklyn Union Gas Company, as they were then called, sent over guys who were diving into the pool with heaters. I mean, it was a full on, you know, all hands on deck Brooklyn effort. Anyway, we realized we were having a gala that night. We had, you know, 1,000 people coming to the gala, 2,000 people in the audience because Pina Bausch was, you know, very controversial. People wanted to see her. And we knew we weren't going to get the water ready in time. So Harvey went out on the stage and said that we were having this water crisis and, you know, whoever wanted a refund could have it, that we were probably going to start around an hour late. But all of the guests in the meantime could adjourn to the lobby. And it so happened that Remy Martin was the sponsor of the gala. So we just told everyone that we were going to crack open the Remy and everybody was going to have a very extended pre-show cocktail. So by the time the show started, everyone kind of stayed. It was one of those BAM nights.
Yeah.
And the whole house was completely inebriated.
Plastered.
Everyone was plastered. When the rhinoceros came out, people went crazy.
Yeah, sure.
The dancers, you know, the water finally got heated up. And it was one of those great BAM nights for the books where the audience just went for the ride along with what was happening on stage. And this was sort of the way we lived our lives in the world of BAM.
Yeah, I love it. All right. I do want to talk a little business. There's so much great advice, both for fundraisers, yes, for leaders, for teams and organizations. And of course, I think you and I both agree with this. The theater teaches you. Is the greatest teacher for how to work inside ensembles and teams. One of the things you write, you say, quote, "The trap that many organizations fall into is the routine of doing business as usual, one particular way, without regularly questioning their methods or outcomes. Just because a strategy worked once doesn't mean it will work again. Sometimes the difference between failure and success is taking something old and replacing it with something new, or perhaps just repackaging it." And to me, that is like the reframe. You know, we know this from our art in terms of like, you got to reframe this thing, but you need to do that in business as well, because it could be a matter of inches between what is successful and what isn't. And we know this from theater, right? Like a director will say, cheat out on that line, and suddenly the line gets a huge laugh. No different on the business end, yet you have the two traps. The one is just do it the same way or change everything. And I think what you're calling for is kind of a level of experimentation that you're constantly doing to figure out what the right move is.
You know, if something is working, it's working. But when things start to get old and things stop working, that's the moment when you have to rethink and redo. And we were constantly, with the kind of work that we were putting on the stage, we were constantly addressing the best way to raise money, the best way to market it. I mean, no one ever heard of these artists, so it was very complicated to sell the tickets and even more complicated to raise the money. You know, my book really deals with three strands of content: artists and celebrities and the show stories, fundraising and leadership, and then, you know, building successful, inclusive, creative neighborhoods powered by the arts, which is the Brooklyn story and has become a story for many neighborhoods and cities and communities around this country and around the world. In this particular case, we had to rethink the way that we were doing things in order to make them more exciting to an audience that was quite young. Our audience was running, say, 20 plus years younger than Lincoln Center, Carnegie Hall, and so forth. So in order to appeal to a young audience like that, this was great. You constantly had to find ways for them to discover new things. So the path here was, how do you take a program and turn it into an event? And then how do you package that so that you have a series of events in a multi-year context that you can raise money for? Mm-hmm. So what we would do is look at the program list that was coming up and then see where things might fit together. We kind of package them, wrap a bow around them, so to speak, and create an initiative. And then we could go out and raise money for a multi-year initiative. And that meant we didn't have to redo it every time. We had 3 years worth of money, and we were able to go deeper with our audience into that particular content. So the idea was to continue to look at ways to create events instead of programs and initiatives instead of a list of random things. And this also helped the audience understand things better.
Yeah.
And become more familiar. And it gave them a path to discovery of what we were trying to do. And it was kind of a fun path, you know, because some of the things were really crazy and they would discover them and they would talk about them. And sometimes they would hate it and sometimes they would love it, because that's the nature of the theater business. You know, you're not going to love every show that you put on stage. But I always said, even if you hated something at BAM, you'd remember it.
Yeah. That
you remember why you hated it. You know, like, it had a kind of, things had teeth, you know, and they were pushing you to learn something or experience something or discover something. And that was the nature of the program. And that's what made it worthwhile. That's what made it worthwhile for the audience. And that's what, frankly, made it worthwhile for the donors and the artists. You know, it was a voyage of discovery every minute.
And it's one that you acknowledge in the book, and anyone who's been in the theater for as long as you and I have understands this, which is like it every aspect of it matters, from what your art looks like to the way the phone gets picked up, to how you walk into the venue, to the show, to after the show, you know, and it's so all encompassing. Which is hard for people, because I think, you know, you tend to think, well, I should be able to just do, everything should be able to work A, B, C, and it should be linear. And it's never linear. It's like, there's no linear. It is up and down. And in the section, chapter 7, you have successful fundraising in 12 steps. And for your personal 6, I love your first one, which is, number 1, don't take it personally.
Exactly.
If you take, because that's, you're done. You're cooked if you take it personally.
You know, fundraising is mostly about rejection and misery and disappointment. Yes. And that's your starting point.
That's your starting
point. So if you go out 50 times and come back 5 having succeeded, you're doing pretty well. So if you take it personally, you are not going to be able to survive it. This is why it's not a job for everyone. You have to have... you know, delayed gratification is the fundraiser's creed. That's the thing that I always say. And you have to have a lot of patience for it. And you have to have a lot of strategy. So you have to be both good at telling your story. You have to be efficient, because no one wants to be bored by you taking a long time to get over the hump of explaining why you're there. You have to be able to write well And you've got to be able to sort of get to the heart about why the thing is great when you are asking a donor to support the program. You have to do your research. You have to make sure that you understand what your donor's interests are. I mean, this is a real business, and you have to be good at it technically, in addition to being okay with it personally.
Yeah.
Because if you fall apart every time someone says no to you, you will not make it in the world of fundraising. It's not the career for you.
So BAM was close to $1 million in debt when you and Joe took over leadership. When you left, what was the endowment?
I don't even remember if we how the debt, you know, the Harvey story was that under every rock, there was another crisis. And it took me 10 years, basically, to clean it all up. Now, I loved him.
Yep.
I don't hold it against him. He did what he had to do to get those shows on the stage. But I made it my goal that we would have a perfectly clean balance sheet. We would have some reserves. And we would begin to build an endowment. And the board, really, led by our chairman, Alan Fishman at the time, the board initiated the endowment campaign. We didn't have an endowment until 1992. And when you think about the fact that BAM opened its doors in 1861, that's a long time not to have stability. When I left, we had an endowment that was approaching $100 million. And it was blood, sweat, and tears to raise that, because that was on top of what we needed for the annual operating goals. But endowments give you forever. Endowments give you life over all the hard times, the good times, all times. And this is why universities have them, hospitals have them, great institutions have them, because it gives you an annual source of passive income in a certain way if your investment strategy is good. So we made a commitment to that. We had a separate board, the BAM Endowment Trust, that was a mix of board members and not board members, non-board members, so that we wouldn't just invade it anytime somebody wanted to. There was a very rigorous process of getting an annual draw. And we built things that had rules and parameters. And we did that because we knew that that was in the institution's best interest at that time in its evolution. The Harvey era was different than our era. We had to bring more stability and still keep the edge on the programs.
Yeah.
So it was a different time. So we had to employ all lessons learned from him in order to be the next and best iteration of ourselves.
So in a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story, but I was struck by, you know, both our careers and the timing of it. So I stepped down from running Second City in 2016. This is around the time I think you left. I found a way to stay at Second City doing other stuff. But we both experienced great loss. I lost a daughter to cancer, and you lost a husband. And I'm just curious from your particular perch, because for me, going through, Nora was sick for a year, and then we lost her. But my theater community carried me.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that I would be sitting here talking to you with that.
Yeah.
And it just feels to me, you don't necessarily talk about it in the book, but I have to imagine you experienced a similar thing.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm so sorry for your loss. And in my case, it was so sudden.
Yeah.
And Ron passed suddenly 10 days after my retirement gala. So in a minute, everything was gone.
Everything.
BAM was gone after 36 years of being my home and my place and my rock. And Ron was gone. And I just was shattered and shocked. But the community, like you said, the institution, my friends, my family, my son, my granddaughters, all of the people, the artists, everyone rallied around.
Yeah.
And you just have to try to feel like yourself one day at a time. You know,
right,
what they say is true, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for people like us who just can't stop, you know, we have to keep rolling and we have to have projects and we have to, like people always said to me, what's the thing you're going to miss most about leaving BAM? And I said, it's simple, bossing people around. When you're used to bossing people around all the time, you have to find a way to continue doing that. And so I was lucky that I was invited to the Mellon Foundation for a 2-year fellowship post my retirement that gave me a place to be. It was quieter. They helped me understand what a research project was rather than just like doing a thing. Yeah. And through that process and the support of the community, I began to feel better. And I began to, you know, feel like myself again. And, but look, my life is different now than it was then. Mm-hmm. It's a different life. I wrote the book because I promised Harvey that I would tell our story. And I felt like I also told it for Ron. I told it for everybody that was part of those remarkable years where Brooklyn went from being sort of a joke and a Manhattan wannabe to the coolest neighborhood on the planet. We did that. Yeah. We did that through art. And that inspired me to write the book. Yeah. And that in itself was also a healing experience. It took time and it wasn't easy, but in the end, it was great. It was great.
Yeah. You have to write these things down and you have to tell the stories. And that's part of the healing too. For me is, you know, I do a lot of public speaking in front of people and I love telling Nora stories. She was hilarious. And is so much, it keeps her with me. And it's part of the greater story. Cause you know, my wife has worked at Second City 2 years longer than I have. And like the kids were raised here. I mean, it's just like, you know, and that was generally true for the people who came before me too. You know, the mentors I learned from. It's not the same today necessarily, I think, in a lot of theater companies. And we're you and I talked before about all those folks that we work with over the years who led the Chicago theater, and one by one they're sort of stepping down and you're like, all right, what's next? But the thing is, here's what we know. There always is going to be a what's next.
You know, and it's also that this is the course of life. And I think we're the lucky ones.
Yeah.
We had jobs and places where we could have ideas and they could be done, that we walked into buildings every day where people were making music, dancing, telling stories, running around. It was, it's the most wonderful life, a life in the arts, a life in a creative setting. With all of the craziness and the never having money and all the aggravation, I would never choose any other life.
Yeah, same. All right. We always end the podcast asking our guests for a yes and story. You have so many to choose from.
Now, do you want one that's programmatic or do you want one that's business wise? I mean, you have to give me a little more direction here.
You know, there are so many incredible stories in the book, in the face of the Princess Di story, getting her to come, you know, I think you have a yes and philosophy, I think, in both ways, both in terms of the business, but also in terms of the approach to the art, and the way the business and art connect. I am fine with any of those stories.
Okay, so since I talked about doing foreign language theater, I'll tell a good Harvey story that was a yes and. So there was a bank that had decided for some anniversary of its banking that it was going to send Ingmar Bergman's Hamlet from the Royal Dramatic Theater of Sweden to the United States. And this Hamlet was 4 hours long. And it was a big, big production. They were going to pay for it, but it was going to be done in Swedish with no surtitles. Okay. So every theater in New York turned it down.
They didn't want to do it.
Except for Harvey. He said, we're doing it. Mm-hmm. And I said to him, okay, we're doing it. And we're doing it in the Opera House with 2,000 seats for 2 weeks. So I'm going like, oh, my God. Harvey,
there's not that many Swedish people in New York, are there?
I said to him, this time you've really gone crazy. We're going to run 2 weeks, 2,000 seats in the Opera House for a 4-hour play that's in Swedish. How are we going to succeed here? He said to me, don't worry about it. The audience knows the play. And I went, okay. He was right. We sold the thing out.
Yeah.
So there you have it.
I love it. The book is called Bam, and Then It Hit Me. Farron Brooks Hopkins, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. Great to talk to you. Thank you.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Adulthood, no one survived.